From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the paradox of modern parenting.
The highs are great. There is something transcendent about the experience itself. But the day-to-day strains are really, really tough.
We talk with Jennifer Senior, author of All Joy and No Fun, about how having and raising children changes the lives of parents, affects their levels of happiness and stress, and can change the course of a marriage. She also writes about how new parents cope with prolonged sleep deprivation.
The population essentially divides into thirds. One third of the population seems to be okay. Another third are compromised and kind of cranky, and then another third react catastrophically. And you absolutely don't know who you're going to be.
Unfortunately, Senior was in the third category. Also, John Powers tells us about the Danish TV series Borgen, which he calls an antidote to cynical American political dramas. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jennifer Senior, writes about how children change the lives of their parents, for better and sometimes for worse, in her new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She considers the impact of children on marriage, sex, work, friendships, and one's sense of self. Her book draws on a wide variety of studies, surveys, and histories, as well as her own interviews with parents. She says she's tried to show how all this research is reflected in the lives of real families, in their kitchens and bedrooms, during carpool, and over homework hours as they go about their daily business. Senior is the mother of a 6-year-old son. She's a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Jennifer Senior, welcome to Fresh Air. So what does All Joy, No Fun mean to you?
It's a very economical way of describing, I think, the experience of parenting. It's a phrase that a friend of mine used almost parenthetically. It was this very offhand kind of comment that he had made when he became a new dad. That's how he described parenthood. He said that it was all joy and no fun. I think meaning that the highs are great, that there is something transcendent about the experience itself, but that the day-to-day strains are really, really tough and might interfere with what we traditionally think of as fun.
Do you think there are ways in which being a parent has been sentimentalized in our culture?
Oh, my God, yes. In the way that, like, almost like if you read a Jane Austen novel, the way that, like, getting married was sentimentalized or something. I mean, in a way, it's become the capstone to a middle-class life. I mean, you do everything first if you're a middle-class person. You get your education first. You settle into your career first. You get married first. You buy your house first. And then, oh, this big thing, you have a kid. And also, there's kind of a historic transformation one can almost look at that shows the moment that having children was sentimentalized, which was really, like, let's say between 1890 to 1920, activists really started, you know, aggressively protesting child labor. And around that time, kids became economically worthless and emotionally priceless. These are the words of a very shrewd and wonderful sociologist named Viviana Zelizer. And she pointed out that kids just became these vulnerable, priceless creatures rather than economic assets in the family. And ever since then, steadily and surely, they have become these exalted creatures at the center of our lives. It's become, I think, in some ways much less clear what a parent's role is. We're now not exactly sure what we do in relation to our kids, and that's very hard, I think.
What do you mean by that? Because I think parents do know what they do in relation to their kids. They raise them and teach them about life and feed them and shelter them.
Right, but you know, that is in fact true. But, I mean, if you go to a bookstore and you look at, like, the parenting shelves, they're just heaving with guides, right? I mean, there's just, like, a zillion of them. And when children were economically valuable to us, the parents' role was really very clear. We provided food and shelter for them, and we probably provided them education, you know, because kids weren't going to public schools and completing high school until, like, 1940. That's when about 50% of all American kids graduated from school. Okay, then kids stopped working for the family. And our jobs became twofold. Number one, it was to kind of nurture them, but we're nurturing them for a future that we absolutely can't fathom. And the other thing is, parents now think that they are supposed to be shoring up their children's self-esteem. They think that they're supposed to be making their children happy now that we regard children as very precious and valuable and priceless. But if you think about it, that's a really weird goal. I mean, it's very hard to teach your child to be happy and to be self-confident. It's not like teaching them how to do math or how to plow a field. You know, teaching your children happiness is a very vague and elusive idea.
Now, you say in the book, and I thought this was really interesting, and I can't say I've thought about it this way before, but there was a time when scholars were mainly concerned with the effect of parents on children. And what impact are the parents having on children? How are they raising the children? But now a lot of people are writing about the impact of children on their parents. What's changed? Why is that happening?
I think that there's been one broad thing that scholars have looked at, which is, do children compromise or improve their parents' happiness? And what's so interesting is that for the past 50 years, scholars have been actually looking at this question and discovering that children don't improve their parents' happiness really at all. They either have no effect or if they have a slight negative effect. They might be responsible for more highs, but they are also responsible for more lows. I guess, why is it? I'd say that, well, number one, we have turned into what the sociologist William White calls it, a filiarchy. We now look at children as being at the center of things. So maybe it was only a matter of time before we looked at how kids affected their parents. I think also one of the big transformations in the 20th century was that the expectation of happiness was now like ubiquitous throughout the developed world. We thought we were entitled to it, which is interesting. If your other needs were met, food, clothing, shelter, all of that, being happy was now an expectation. So people started looking at how different things affected your happiness, your income, your marital status, and inevitably, if you had kids.
So as you were saying, it used to be believed that couples were happier with children and that children could even help save a marriage. But some of the latest research contradicts that. So tell us about some of the research you've read about the correlation between the happiness of a couple and whether or not they have children.
Yeah, that is depressingly some of the most robust research out there, that the transition to parenthood is incredibly difficult for couples. I don't know if it was ever true that, as a matter of research, kids improved marriages. Starting from the 1950s, there was good evidence that they were, in fact, compromising marriages. And this started with a study by E.E. LeMasters in 1957. There's been tons of work, particularly by this couple called the Cowans, Carolyn and Philip Cowan, out in Berkeley, who've been looking at this for probably a quarter of a century. And what they notice is that parents fight more. They fight more aggressively. Kids seem to cause a lot of strain in a marriage, and a lot of it is about the division of labor. I think that since women started working, this has become incredibly tense. We don't have scripts for this. We still don't know who does what now that women work.
When somebody has a baby, they're always told, you're not going to get any sleep for a long time. But you point out that some people truly can't deal with sleep deprivation and that it is sleep deprivation. I mean, there's going to be a period of time when you're just getting a few hours of sleep a night, if you're lucky, and that for some people that's fine. For some people that's, it's difficult, but for some people, it's just kind of impossible to handle.
The population essentially divides into thirds in terms of how it copes with sleep deprivation. And by the way, it knows no gender. It's not that men are better at it or women are better at it. It's there's really no telling. But one third of the population seems to be okay when they experience protracted sleep loss. I mean, they're cranky, but they're functional and they're reasonably polite to the people around them. Another third are compromised and kind of cranky and things aren't so great. And then another third react catastrophically, like they're just basket cases. And you absolutely don't know who you're going to be. It's not like any of the previous experiences that you've had with sleep deprivation are analogous. Like those all-nighters that you might have pulled at a job or in college or doing a night shift, they're not going to be terribly predictive unless they were, for weeks and weeks and possibly years on end. There's no way to know. And by the way, I was a category three. I was like a banana boat. I mean, I was just terrible on no sleep. And I thought I wasn't going to be because I was a veteran insomniac. I mean, I was a very practiced insomniac. I prided myself on knowing how to conduct my affairs on 2 to 3 hours of sleep. But it turns out to be different because it's very stressful, interrupted sleep. So, yeah, that was one of the most crazy-making kind of studies to run across. And it was well-designed. And it had like a large population sample. So I'm guessing it's going to be replicated.
So I'm wondering, when you were sleep deprived and couldn't handle it, did that lead to depression? Did it lead to you questioning whether you were a good mother or should have become a mother in the first place?
Let's see. Yes, no, and no. Depression, yes, it made me very depressed for sure. Did it question my becoming a mom? No. I think because... So in the middle of the night, even though it's like the worst, right? You're so tired and you're just looking at your kid and going, please go back to bed. Like, you know, like, please. The thing is, some of the most magical things happen in the middle of the night. So like my kid at 1 month looked directly at me at one point and kind of cooed. It was this recognition. It was like, oh, like you're my mom. And I'd like to think that when I'm dying, I'll remember that because it was really wild. And if you don't have any religious instincts, which unfortunately I don't, I was like born without them, that is like as close as I'm going to come to awe. So even in my like depressive, sleep deprived, hysterical, Looney Tunes state, like I remembered thinking that was just the bomb. It was really magic.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Senior. She's the author of the new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She's also a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Senior. She is a contributing editor at New York Magazine and author of the new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. And this is a good point to mention, that you point out that your book is really focused on middle-class parents because, like, parents who are poor have so many other complicating factors in their lives, like not having enough money for food, having like lots of jobs in order to keep things running, or maybe having no job and living on various assistance programs, and that those are complicating factors that are kind of different from what the middle class faces, and you didn't want to kind of confuse the two. Did I explain that clearly?
You totally did, and I'm glad you said it. But yes, I mean, if you have to work three jobs, or if you have to commute, you know, 2.5 hours each way to your job, and if you're barely making ends meet, your parenting life just looks very different than somebody whose job is a normal commuting distance away and who makes a normal, you know, living wage, you know. I also, though, just to point out, did not write about parents who were very, very wealthy either. I think almost every kid in my book went to public school. There were very few people who made, like, lots and lots of money, because if you have lots and lots of money to throw at your problems, it also makes your life much easier. And if you have round-the-clock childcare and you can go out a lot and you can outsource a lot of the difficult parts of parenting, I don't think you're having the same experience either.
Another study that you cite in your book, All Joy and No Fun, is about mothers dealing with empty nests after their child or children have left, and you said that the conventional wisdom is that the mother despairs at the empty nest, but this study found that actually mothers became happier, a majority of mothers became happier when they had no children at home anymore.
Yeah, this is interesting and also replicated consistently, and it's fascinating. Men tend to be sadder than women. The first study that was ever done on this was in 1975, and it's been replicated many times since. The most interesting findings surrounding this particular point have to do with the way mothers respond to their adolescent children. They seem to weather adolescence worse than dads, particularly if they have daughters, but I think just generally, they are so alive to the tensions in the house and the anger in the house and those rejecting kind of behaviors of their kids that they've been all along kind of separating from their children and feeling the kind of hurt of separation. So when their child finally leaves, I think many of them experience it as a bit of a relief, and it's just not quite so painful, and then they're able to enjoy having raised their child. I think a lot of it is that, you know, that just the pain of adolescence. Oh, and also during adolescence, as a P.S., mothers are the enforcers. They're the cops. They're the bad cops. They're the nags. You know, they spend more time with their children generally. So just imagine all these fights that you're getting into where you're trying to regulate screen time and trying to regulate who kids' friends are, which they really resent. You know, they don't like that. And they're weighing in on your musical tastes, you know, and your adolescent doesn't like that. And then finally, your kid leaves and you think, well, I've done my part. You know, I can't do anymore. And so a lot of mothers, it was surprising to me, they experienced this as a relief.
Something that I have to say really surprised me in your book, and sounds really counterintuitive. You know, and this I understand. Today, parents pour more capital, emotional and financial, into their children than ever before. And certainly, I think it is more expensive than ever before to have a child. But you're right that studies show parents are spending longer, more concentrated hours with their children than they did when the workday ended at 5 and most women stayed home. Can you explain that?
No. I mean, yes, of course I can explain the forces that contributed to that. But, I mean, every time I read that statistic, and it's a meticulously compiled statistic, you know, it's done from the American Time Use Studies, where Americans sit down and fill out a form describing everything they do for every minute of the day. I mean, this is one of the it's a gold mine. It's one of the best long-running longitudinal studies that we have. It's really fantastic. Why this would be, I mean, I have a couple of theories. One is that I think, first of all, we are now under the impression that in order to get our children ahead, you know, we really have to cultivate them. That being average is no longer sufficient, that, you know, you have to be outstanding. And that is going to require a lot of extra time and effort. So there's this woman in my book who I really liked. She was a lovely, very sympathetic woman. And she said to me, it was this like little epigrammatic gem. She said, you know, I think homework is the new dinner. Like, her dinner table had been totally given over to her kids' homework, and she was just sitting there working on it with them. And she didn't know how to cook. Like, it was just, like, filled with the detritus of, like, some takeout meal. Like, what they were doing at that table was not eating. You know, they were, like, reading and doing writing assignments and doing math. That was her way of giving to her children, not standing at a stove and making them a meal while they sat and played on the floor or played outside. And I think it was just part of this deep-seated anxiety she had about getting them ahead. The other thing is that I do think that because so many women are working now, there is this intense pressure on them to also show that they are deeply, you know, committed mothers. And I think that one of the best indicators that we have of this transformation is in this little switcheroo in language that we have. In the 1960s, if you stayed home with your kids, what were you? You were a housewife. You focused on your house. You didn't focus on your kids. You focused on your house. Your house had to be clean. You had to master the differences between oven cleaners and floor waxes and stuff that made your wood nice and shiny. But you put your kids in a playpen. Like, that's what you did. And now, if you stay home with your kids, you are a stay-at-home mom. You focus on your kids. You are a professional mom. And you focus on the right toys for your kids, the right educational things for your kids. So all the women who are working, when they are not working, they want to be professional moms too. So they are pouring all of this energy into their children in their off hours. And by the way, their houses are suffering. Their houses are a mess. If you look at the American time use surveys, no one takes care of their house anymore. They're very, you know, that's a very clear downward slope, which is funny to me and tracks with my own life. You know,
Make me feel better.
Yeah, it should make you feel better. It's true, right. And it's true, by the way, of parents and non-parents alike. So, yeah.
Jennifer Senior will be back in the second half of the show. Her new book is called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, crafting shiatsu massage chairs for over 50 years, and makers of the DreamWave Total Body Massage Chair at dreamwavechair.com. From eSurance, insurance for the modern world, offering online and mobile car insurance tools to guide customers from quote to claim, esurance.com. And from Netflix, with season 2 of House of Cards, starring Kevin Spacey, Robin Wright, and Kate Mara. All episodes premiere on Friday, February 14th on Netflix. This is NPR.
Coming up, Jennifer Senior talks about dealing with adolescent children and why that period is so stressful on a marriage. And John Powers reviews Borgen, a Danish TV drama series about Denmark's first woman prime minister. He says it's an antidote to cynical American political dramas like House of Cards. The third and final season is now out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jennifer Senior, author of the new book All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She's drawn on research studies, history, and her own interviews to examine how children affect their mothers' and fathers' lives and describe what today's parents find so challenging about raising children. Senior is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. When we left off, she was saying that women who stayed home with their children in the 60s were called housewives, but now they're called stay-at-home moms, with the implication that they're spending most of their time interacting with their children. I was thinking back to my memories of when my mother stayed home to raise the children. And, you know, like before I went to school or when I'd come home from school, in the afternoon, my memories really are not so much of my mother like playing with me or doing homework with me. My memories are more of me being in my room, either playing with a friend or playing by myself, or if I was older, like doing homework. Well, my mother did her thing, you know, which was cleaning the house or maybe talking on the phone with a friend. But, you know, shopping for food, preparing the food. She was always busy with something, but it wasn't necessarily parenting. But she was there. You know, it was very, I always knew she was there. And I always knew that my brother and I were the most important things in her life, period. No questions asked, no doubt about it. But it doesn't mean that she was playing with me all the time or focusing on me all the time, you know, during your typical day.
It's so true. And it's amazing, right? Because her love ran in the background for you. I mean, you just said it.
Oh, it was just a given. It was unquestionable.
I have to say, I just listened to that and I am so envious. You know, I try to practice that, right? It's hard. I mean, I think there is this real expectation from all of our kids now that we should be their playmates. And I am constantly saying to my kid, you know, you're bored, go clean your room, you know, like, or go like play with your stuff. You've got so much stuff. And our kids have way more stuff than like you and I had when we were kids. Like there's plenty for them to do. Not to mention like many electronic babysitting options, which no one likes to talk about. But, you know, you can also send your kid off to go play chess on the iPad if you want to feel virtuous about sending your kid off to play with the iPad. You know, and yet all of us feel like we have to be deeply, aggressively interactive. And I'm not clear on whether or not kids benefit from that. I mean, people are looking at that now and claiming that it's backfiring and that this form of helicoptering is not as good for a child's self-esteem as the kind of drone model that our parents had, which was kind of like they were more remote. And I have to say, I just think it's really hard on parents. And I do question whether it's good for kids, just because it might set up this very unrealistic expectation that, like, if they snap their fingers, someone's going to be there to answer them. I mean, it's like we've all become Jeeves and they're Bertie Wooster. It's a little weird, you know?
Let's talk a little bit about adolescence, which is, I think, a particularly hard period for many parents.
Oh, my God. I mean, again, it's documented in these ways that are so meticulous and almost funny. I mean, there are researchers who have actually taken the pains. A woman named Susan McHale, I mean, this was she's at Penn State. She did this unbelievable study where she looked at kids who are not yet adolescent. They were just faltering on the precipice of adolescence. And then checked in with them later as their voices began to break, if they were boys, or as they were starting to get their periods, if they were girls, and started like, and checked to see how their parents were doing. And sure enough, their parents started doing worse the minute these changes started happening. I mean, it was kind of amazing. I mean, how rigorously designed her work was. Yeah. I mean, it's been shown.
So adolescence is often the most stressful period for the parents' marriage.
It appears that way. Yeah, that's what the graphs tend to look like. And I think some of it, too, is that, look, you're not having arguments anymore about, like, whether or not you should be feeding your kids, like, soft foods or hard foods. And you're not, like, having arguments about, like, hey, look, I got up last night with a kid. Would you please get up with the kid tonight, like, and cut me some slack? You're having arguments about, like, your child's work ethic and whether that kid's being, you know, is turning into a moral creature. And you're also doing something that might be slightly dangerous, which is that you're projecting. Like, this is something that a UCLA psychologist talked to me at length about. And it was really poignant. And it made so much sense. And it was almost novelistic, his descriptions. He said he would get couples coming into his office. And, you know, one of their kids would be like, kind of showing a little bit of laziness. And the wife would turn to the husband and say, you know, well, in the same way that you are kind of not that aggressive when you try to ask for a raise, like our son's doing that now, you know, or like the husband would look at the wife and say, well, gee, our daughter's turning into a screamer. I wonder where she got that. You know, I mean, these are really painful fights, you know, that you're looking at your kid and seeing like the incipient stages of adulthood and adult characteristics, things that, you know, you can't really dismiss traits anymore as just being like phases or cute, you know, you got to reckon with them.
You also write about some of the neurological underpinnings of the risk-taking, sometimes foolish risk-taking, and combativeness that a lot of adolescents, teenagers express. What are some of those neurological things going on?
Wow, yeah, they're crazy. So the adolescent brain is this really interesting thing. First of all, the prefrontal cortex is not quite done developing. And the prefrontal cortex is what is responsible for kind of rational decision-making and planning and impulse control. So there's a reason that, like, teenage kids, like, take dumb risks, you know? I mean, the mechanism that actually should be functioning as their brake pedal is not fully developed. It's a rather weak brake. They also tend to sort of overestimate the reward that they will get from taking risks, which is interesting to me. Their brains are just awash in dopamine, which is the feel-good hormone. So they feel everything very, 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 very intensely. And that's everything from crushes to, you know, rejection. It's the good and the bad. So it's a real adventure having them in the house. What's so interesting is that it now looks like the prefrontal cortex keeps developing like right into your like mid-20s. So the only kind of group of people who seem to figure this out before neuroscientists was car insurance companies. Like they actually knew you do not give a car to anyone under the age of 25. Like I guess it was showing up like in their statistics. Like these people like drive like maniacs and there's a reason. So there you go.
You suggest it might be better if adolescents had more productive approaches to risk-taking so that they weren't doing kind of like crazy things, but they were doing real things that required risk but had like more of a realistic goal.
Exactly. So when kids had a chance to go out prospecting for themselves, I'm now using the words of Margaret Mead, actually, and she noticed this, that there was a time when adolescents, you know, I had this kind of as-if period where they could experiment as if they were doing something. You know, they could play around with a profession. They could take real risks that had tangible kind of effects and rewards. They could see what they wanted to do with their lives, you know. It was much better for them. I think that those risk-taking impulses were sublimated in ways that made more biological sense than they do now.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Senior, author of the new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Senior. We're talking about her new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She's a contributing editor at New York Magazine, and she has a six-year-old son and two stepchildren. Let's get back to talking about toddlers and preschoolers. You point out that there are so many moments in a parent's day when they're trying to get their toddler or preschooler to do something or to compromise on something. and how exhausting that is, and how you never know, like, so when do you just give in?
Yeah. It's the hardest calculation for a parent to make, again, particularly if they've been working in rational environments, you know, where, like, rational discourse is kind of the coin of the realm. You know, if you are a college-educated woman, odds are you are 30.3 years old when you have your first kid. So you've had, like, 10 years behind you of kind of being in the workforce, or let's say 8 or 5 or whatever, and talking to people where, like, you say something and they say something back and it all makes sense. And then you have, like, a 2-year-old and you say something and nothing makes sense because, you know, they can't reason yet. Toddlers do not have the machinery to reason. They live in the permanent present. They barely have any prefrontal cortexes to speak of. But all of us seem to make the same mistake. We argue with them as if logic will have any sway over these kids. But they don't. It can't really. I mean, their brains aren't optimized for logic. That's not what they do. I mean, little kids are like insects with eyes all over their heads. You know, they're kind of just sweeping in the world, and they're living in the present, and they're, like, taking in a lot of stimuli. But, like, if you say to them, no, you can't have that cookie right now, you've got to have that cookie in, like, 10 minutes, like, it's a catastrophe for them. They do not know what 10 minutes from now means because, you know, what your prefrontal cortex does is explains to you that all things will come in good time, that, you know, if you just wait and you restrain your impulses, then, you know, you will be rewarded later. I mean, that's not where they live. It's not where they are. So it just winds up being this kind of temporal mismatch and this kind of mismatch in sensibilities. And as an instructor pointed out to me, no 3-year-old or 2-year-old has ever looked at their mother or father and said, oh, yeah, you're right. That's a really great point, Mom. Okay. Like, they never do that.
So in addressing, like, the neurological underpinnings of the behavior of a toddler, how does the prefrontal cortex come into play here?
Okay, so the prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain that plans, that reasons, and very importantly for a toddler, that kind of manages impulses. You know, it's responsible for impulse control. So you can imagine that if you, as a parent, are reckoning with a small person whose prefrontal cortex is barely developed, and that is true of a toddler, then you're going to be spending a lot of time trying to explain to them that the things they want, they can't always get, and they will get them later. But later is a very hard concept for them. And understanding gratification as a thing that will eventually come doesn't happen so much. It's very hard to reason with a toddler. That's what the prefrontal cortex does. It's responsible for reasoning. It's responsible for planning. So, you know, just imagine having a human being in your house who lives in the present, in the moment, all the time, while you're trying to plan. You're trying to plan your day. You're trying to get them out the door to go to school. You're trying to convince them why it's a good idea to wear snow boots, you know, and they don't see why it's a good idea to wear snow boots. You know, they're not thinking, rationally about, oh, yes, there's snow on the ground outside, and therefore I should probably dress appropriately. That's not how a toddler thinks. And a lot of that is because the prefrontal cortex is not completely developed.
You also point out that one of the most, you know, frustrating things about parenthood when you have a toddler is that the toddler can't reason and you can't reason with them. But that also it's one of the most delightful things about having a child because your toddler's living in the moment in the way that you don't, and it can bring you into the moment and make you just see things differently.
Oh, my God. It's one of the hardest things for parents to do, but it is also a true revelation if you can do it. What it means to us modern people is deciding to turn off our cell phones, right? And maybe, like, not checking our email. If you can live with your kid in the permanent present, it's like a lovely place to be. And it's why people, when they meditate, try and be in the permanent present. I mean, there's a lot to be said for living right in that moment, right there with your kid, eyeball to eyeball. They live tactily, you know, they live, like, through their senses. So they're all about, like, kind of getting their hands gooey playing with Play-Doh and mud and stuff like that. And, you know, they like building things and making snow forts. And if you can just suspend all that noise, if you can just ignore that running endless ticker tape of concerns that's just looping and whipping through your head, it is glorious.
We have kind of focused a lot on what studies say about the difficulties of being a parent. So let's kind of switch it for a second. Your book is called All Joy and No Fun. Let's get to some of the joy. And I don't know how many of the studies that you refer to in your book really focus on joy. So you want to give some equal time to joy?
I'd love to. And, you know, the studies don't focus on it so much. I have to sort of go to philosophy and novels in order to discuss the joy. The problem with these studies is that if you're feeling good about something, you know, you rank it a five. So that moment that I was describing with my baby looking at me and cooing at me, which was like just this transcendent moment in my life, would rate the same if I'm doing everything on a scale of one to five as like a dinner with a friend, if I had a really great time at that dinner. In the same way that, like, you know, on Amazon, you know, a John Grisham novel and, you know, and Charles Dickens, like, kind of get fives, you know, but they're not necessarily the same experience, you know. And also, I can't remember who said this to me. I think it was George Valant, a psychiatrist who's kind of a poet philosopher, too. He pointed out that, like, it's kind of like using a number to describe a taste. You know, how do you do that? So I think that social science misses a lot of the joy. And, you know, one of the remarkable things about joy is that it is sort of predicated on this idea of being very connected to somebody. I think Christopher Hitchens described, you know, having kids as, you know, your heart running around in somebody else's body. And that feeling is so powerful, it's almost scary, because there's almost like an implied sense of loss about it. It's like you love somebody so much that you are almost automatically afraid of losing them, like that this connection is so deep that you can't think of that connection without thinking of that connection being broken. So joy in some ways is almost a harder feeling to tolerate than sadness in some ways, because it's so powerful and makes us so vulnerable, but it's why it is also so profoundly special and what makes parenting to so many of us so huge and incomparable.
I'd like to have you end by reading the end of your book and the acknowledgments, the words that you say to your son, who is now six.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for asking me that. I say, without this kid, the world wouldn't be half so beautiful or half so meaningful or half so large. How I love you, darling boy. You'll never know the half of it, and that's just fine.
Jennifer Senior is the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Ironically, although I'd warned him not to listen, this ended up being the last interview our producer John Sheehan worked on before his wife Darla gave birth early Sunday morning. We are so happy for them, in spite of the prolonged sleep deprivation that awaits them. I can't show you the adorable picture of their daughter Lila that John sent, but I can play you the short recording he made in the hospital.
Yeah, but can't I know?
And this is Lila. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the world, Lila. Coming up, John Powers recommends a political TV drama series from Denmark, which he says borrows from and improves on The West Wing. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The Danish television series Borgen, about a female party leader who unexpectedly becomes Denmark's prime minister, was a hit in its home country and in the United Kingdom. It won numerous international prizes and a cult following in the U.S. after its sporadic TV broadcasts. Stephen King named it his favorite piece of pop culture of 2012. The third and final season has just been released on DVD. Our critic at large, John Power, says he downed Borgen in great gulps, and he describes it as irresistibly bingeable.
I've spent most of my life being fascinated by politics. But Washington has grown so stridently dysfunctional, I can barely stand to watch the news. And though I enjoy shows like Veep and House of Cards, they're so devoutly cynical they almost feel like part of the problem. As an antidote to this, I highly recommend Borgen, the crest of the current wave of Danish TV that's given us The Killing and The Bridge. Taking its name from the Copenhagen castle that's the seat of government, Borgen plays like a more astringent version of The West Wing, a show it clearly borrows from and improves on. Its third and final season is just out on DVD, but you'll want to start at the very beginning, which instantly sucks you into the world of Danish politics, with its idealists and ideologues, sleazy tabloids and state-run TV networks, bullying billionaires, and fussy bureaucrats with minds of their own. Borgen's heroine is Birgitte Nyberg, superbly played by Sidse Babette Knudsen, the principled low-key leader of the moderate party. As the series begins, this happily married mother of two rides a freakish turn of events to become Denmark's first woman prime minister. But taking office is one thing. Knowing how to govern is another. Starting each episode with an aphorism from the likes of Machiavelli, Churchill, or Chairman Mao, Borgen shows us Birgitte learning how to run the machinery of power, how to slap down a foe and fire an ally, when to go on TV and when to rise above the fray, when to compromise and when to be steely. Here, she's talking to the brutal dictator of an ex-Soviet republic who's threatening to cancel a huge business deal with Denmark if she doesn't hand over a dissident named Bayanov who's visiting her country. Although the show's in Danish with subtitles, here they speak their common language, English.
What will happen to Bayanov if we hand him over?
Let's not discuss that on a day of celebration like this.
I can't hand him over if you won't tell me.
My dear Prime Minister, it's up to Turkizian people and the Turkizian legal system to decide.
I mean, no offense, Mr. President, but I really need to know more than that.
Let me ask you a question. Why do you consider yourself a better and more democratic leader than I?
Why would you ask me that?
Oh, I think you know. How old is Danish democracy? 160 years? Ours is 20 years old. It takes time, Mrs. Prime Minister. It takes time. Turkizian people not used to being asked, they are used to being told. It is in the DNA of my people to obey the leader.
So, if I understand you correctly, it is you, isn't it, Mr. President, who will decide what will happen to Bayern?
Are we playing games, Mrs. Prime Minister?
I hope not. There's a man's life at stake here.
Well, when our democracy is 160 years old, we can talk. Until then, I will not take any more arrogant lessons from you.
Of course, Birgitte doesn't live in the world alone. Part of what makes Borgen so enjoyable is that it surrounds her with maybe 20 vividly drawn regulars, from the smug opposition leader Hesselbo to the alcoholic old reporter Hannah Holm. Chief among them are Birgitte's spin doctor Kasper Juhl, a Don Draperish sort who learned how to spin as a way of camouflaging his dark past. And the woman he loves, Katrine Fonsmark. She's a sexy but idealistic reporter who has a poster of all the president's men on the door of her apartment. Like Birgitte, both are trying to figure out how to be honest in a world where press secretaries must weasel and reporters must answer to corrupt editors or TV execs who curry the government's favor. I'm not sure I've ever seen a show that's better at capturing the personal cost of political life. For Birgitte, power doesn't so much corrupt as isolate. The more successful she becomes as PM, the more her private world dwindles. Her circle of friends shrinks, Her children feel neglected, and her marriage to the funny liberal-minded Philip, a one-time CEO who's put his career on hold, starts to founder. Losing her knack for intimacy, she begins talking to him like a prime minister making points in a cabinet meeting. Now, I realize that the thought of a Danish cabinet meeting may not exactly make your mouth water. But believe me, the show has plenty to grip an American viewer. For starters, it gives a keen glimpse at how the Danes view us. They're pro-American, yet as a small country, they're often resentful at the way the U.S. can act like the 800-pound gorilla, as when the CIA secretly uses a Danish base for illegal rendition. Beyond this, the issues Birgitta confronts each week are the same ones we face. How to manage immigration, how to assure both security and privacy, how to keep a social safety net in a world where once rising economic competitors cut costs by not having one. In tackling such issues, Birgitta is clearly an idealized figure. Yet Borgen makes it clear that even a virtuous politician can't be as decent as she'd like. Birgitta backs proposals she doesn't quite believe in to enact bigger policies that she does. She works with ministers she'd like to fire but keeps on because it would cost her too much to can them. And she's loyal to her old friends until she has to sacrifice them when they've become a liability. The show doesn't falter for this. Quite the contrary. Borgen reminds us what it's easy to forget in these polarized times, that no political decision is ever pure or simple, and that it's childish to think otherwise.
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the Danish TV series Borgen. All three seasons have been released on DVD by MHZ Networks. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Road Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba this winter, at roadscholar.org. From Joyce V. Hale, supporting NPR's internship program, Building a Future, One Opportunity at a Time. And from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Tim Gunn of Project Runway and the new show, Under the Gun. Although he's now a confident mentor, he had a difficult adolescence. He stuttered, he was in denial about being gay, and he was often bullied. When he was 17, he tried to kill himself. We'll talk about his life and, of course, about fashion. Join us.